I'm Jake, and with me tonight is Hot Stuff. We literally just flew in from Austin.
Yeah.
And boy, are our arms literally tired.
Yeah. So are our butts.
Yeah. That's from all the gay sex in Hot Stuff's case. And I forget why my butt is tired.
Because you were paddling yourself for hours?
That's true. And the bathroom on that plane was very small. I couldn't actually stand up straight to pee.
Did you try sitting down to pee?
No, because the guy before me, that cowboy-looking dude with the long hair and the beard, pissed all over the seat.
Oh, gross.
Fucking prick.
That's really
maybe it wasn't him. It could have been the woman who went in there before him.
I doubt it.
Might have been, though. You never know.
I guess if she was trying to avoid touching anything,
trying
she was, like, hovering. Yeah,
it's possible. That'd be rough on a plane. Let's see.
Well, not the, like, the vomit comet's, in fact, one of the few ways you can hover.
That's true. I'm going to... Elixia says that voice levels are a little quiet, so everybody watch out. I'm going to turn them up a little bit.
Yeah.
Turn them up. All right. Now they're up. Maybe they're too high now. I guess we'll find out. Anyway, we just got back from the Austin Game Developers Convention, so I think what we're going to do for the first half of the show... Sorry, Game Developers Conference?
Wasn't a convention. Yeah, conferences are serious business.
Right.
Like the internet. And conventions are fun. Woohoo!
Conventions are where people cosplay.
Well, because we're having a convention and it's going to be fun. Woohoo!
Wait, we're having a conference, too.
What?
No, we're totally not. people are doing panels on how to make meat. And
that'd be funny, actually, if we just, like, had a
panel discussion.
A parody conference.
Yeah, that would be great. We should take volunteers. to do that during con. We could get some of the. I'm sure we have meeting rooms in the Tempe Center for the Arts.
It's possible.
So yeah, we went on Sunday. That's why I was on my show on Monday. We flew on Sunday night. Did we do anything Sunday night?
We checked into the hotel.
We went down to the bar.
Yeah.
The guy at the front desk was like, "Yeah, the kitchen's open for another half hour. Yeah, you can order something at the bar." We went over to the bar, and we're like, "Yeah, I want to get some food." And he's like,
"Well, first thing he said was kitchen's closed." And we're like, "Really?" Because the guy at the front desk told us that he was open for another half hour. He's like, "Ah." Then he's like,
"He went back and he's not happy about it, but you guys can have some food." I'm like, you know what? I don't give a fuck if he's happy about it or not.
So much for that 4-diamond rating you guys have.
Nobody's happy about doing their goddamn jobs. Except us. We're the only people on Earth who like our jobs.
Yeah, we had so many discussions with people that didn't like their jobs. Even people who worked in the game industry, they're like, "Yeah, I don't like my job." And I'm like, "What? You're making games."
Maybe not everybody's making games the way we're making games.
Smiles on the faces of children.
We talk about making a game, and then we're like all making a game, and we're making the one we talked about, and we're making the one we think we should make, you know?
That's true.
A little different. The conference made us... Up until the last day, the conference made us kind of sad, because we're...
We are not part of the gaming industry.
Yeah, we're really
outsiders. Yeah. It's... we're outside.
We're
not only Washington.
We're Beltway insiders. So Sunday night we did that. We ate and then did we go out drinking?
No, we went out drinking Monday night.
Yeah.
Sunday night things were closed. It was
Yeah.
We went to sleep because we had to get up early because we had to go register.
Oh yeah, we had to go register at like 7 in the morning.
Yeah.
Hot Stuff tried to. We had a barcode we were supposed to print out.
Yeah.
And he printed it out without looking at it, and it turned out to be bigger than an entire sheet of paper. So he had a copy of it on his phone. He tried to get the QCAT to scan it on his phone, but that
did not work.
So he had to check in manually. And then I think what's going to drive our discussion right now, we're going to table the Sunday night, Monday morning discussion for the time being, and move on to this list of action items I have in my pocket. Which is the list
of... This is what happens when you go to a conference,
kid. I know. Look at what's happened to me.
Robert and his rules of order are just going to kick you upside the face.
So the first session that I went to Monday at 9:30 a.m. in room 5 was Endgame, How to Build High-End Gameplay for Your Most Devoted Players by Damian Schubert. Yeah. Damian Schubert is a guy who writes a blog that I read every once in a while, and he worked on some games. He hurt my feelings very badly during that convention, during his speech. He was basically just... The problem that his talk had, the problem that, that session had, was the same problem that almost all of these sessions had, which is that it's like... I don't really know who it's targeted for, because it's like, here's some stuff about the way people make MMOs, and at the end of it, I'm like, well, yeah.
And?
Yeah, you know, because I've seen or played or read about all of the games that you're talking about. And yes, I understand that for an endgame in an MMO, you either need a PvP endgame or you need a PvE endgame.
Or perhaps both. Sure. Novel.
Sure. But anyway, he was talking about, you know, designing PvP systems on, you know, being, and again, it's like stuff that is never going to apply to us because we don't actually have like a big virtual world with multiple people running around in it and that kind of thing.
Right.
And he was talking about, then he started talking about the raiding endgame specifically in World of Warcraft, and he was like, somebody asked a question that said, what do you think about the fact that every time Blizzard releases an expansion to World of Warcraft, it obsoletes all of the raiding content at the old level cap when they raise the new level cap. And his response was, you know, all these armchair designers will sit around and talk about how sad it is that they're obsoleting that content, but the players are thrilled by it. They're thrilled that they don't ever have to run that fucking raid again because they've done it every week for 6 months. And all of the points that he was making the entire time were predicated on the notion that basically everyone who plays World of Warcraft, everyone who plays an MMO is a high-end raider.
Yeah.
And I would just off the cuff, I would probably put the number at 10 or 15%.
I think it might be as high as 25. I think it depends on sort of what metrics you're going to look at. But especially if you include all the churn, if you include all the people who play for a while and then stop playing, and whose accounts aren't counted in the totals,
right?
I think that you'd be correct. I think you'd say that probably 10 or 15% of all people who play World of Warcraft raid for any sort of significant period of time.
So basically, you know, he's just kind of rationalizing, and you know, he doesn't work for them. He doesn't know anything about their numbers. You know, he is talking about this entirely as a player. He admitted in the beginning of the speech that he'd never designed a PvE endgame, right? And
every talk we went to talked about Blizzard to some extent.
Yeah,
Blizzard is just the top dog when it comes to gaming in the modern environment. It's interesting how people either love or despise them.
Basically, everybody there liked them, though. And that was kind of nice, you know? Because the sort of anti World of Warcraft rhetoric gets a little stale after a time, but you know, so it made me, first of all, I would posit that the people who are sad about the content being obsoleted as the level cap raises in World of Warcraft are World of Warcraft players who are demonstrably not thrilled by it, and justifying spending all of your development costs, all of your development resources, catering to people who are doing the high-end end game is, I feel like, you know, it's, I'm not going to say, oh, it's a bad idea because, they, you know, that's what they do and they're clearly making money. I just feel like there is a contingent of people like me and like Hot Stuff that would be happy being thrown a bone in terms of content being added at different levels of the game, because to us, that is new content. To us, we will go see it, even if we're not getting any meaningful rewards for it.
Because for us, the meaningful rewards are the enjoyment of seeing sort of interesting content or new stories or whatever, you know.
So at the very least, especially now, you know, Wrath of the Lich King will come out and everybody will run up to level 80. Then there will be level 60 raids that, you know, a couple people could do, probably. That, you know, 40-man raids, maybe 5 people. 40-man raids could probably be 5 manned by
maybe
a little bit, because they're going to have the same sort of inflation where all of the numbers get significantly bigger.
It depends. It really depends. I mean, there are just certain encounters that require
10 people doing.
Yeah, like
doing 10 different things at once. Yeah, okay.
That's the problem. Is that something like this? They become hard floors.
But what's frustrating is that you can't go see them. In order to go see them, you have to treat it the way that it was being treated back when it was the last thing to do in the game. So there are these complicated sets of attunements that you have to go through. And
well, for the level 60 stuff, the level 70 stuff, I think all the attunements will be gone.
Right, but it's frustrating that they won't do that with a level 60.
They might.
Why wouldn't they?
I don't know. It's interesting to me that they don't repurpose that content a little bit so that, because they're just ignoring the fact that there's a lot of really interesting, really well-designed, really sort of fun stuff that anyone who starts playing World of Warcraft after the expansions doesn't ever get to see because it's just sort of impractical.
And see, maybe they just don't care about those people.
It's possible, but I think that's a sort of major.
I think that it would improve retention to some extent. I don't know that it would improve retention more than adding another raid to the top end, right? You know, he came up with this figure that's just sort of apparently common knowledge in the industry, which is that it costs 10 times as much in marketing to get a new player as it does in development work to keep an existing player.
Yeah, my first talk on Monday at 9:30 a.m. in room 7 was How to Manage Your Online Business During Growth and Decline by Rich Vogel, who's actually one of the guys who, he was involved in Ultima Online and has been doing, you know, MMOs forever, and he was one of the people organizing the conference. And then John Donham, who's I don't know what position he has, but he's one of the head honchos over at Raph Koster's company, the meta place thing, which is an interesting sort of separate thing that we can.
I know that John had worked for Sony at the same time that Raph did.
Okay, that's. I think they've been together for a long time. Yeah. I think they've been a duo. I think they were the two that started Meta Place.
Do you think they're special friends?
I don't know. The the complete misrepresentation of their talk was that MMOs are basically a big funnel that you throw a bunch of money into and then it leaks out the bottom, which isn't entirely true. But one of the things they talked about was that retention is much, much easier than acquisition of new players. So guys, don't stop playing our game.
Yeah, keep playing
because you guys are cool.
we'll put in a new cookie every week. That was one thing in another talk. That basically, he was like, "This is what you got to do to keep people happy," and then he basically described Tuesday updates.
Really?
Yeah. Huh. But it was a different style of game that he was talking about, to be sure.
We can come to that if we want to do things in a.
No, I want to do things in order.
Okay.
So then we went to the keynote speech, which was Lane Merrifield, one of the guys that made Club Penguin.
He's one of the two founders of Club Penguin.
Yeah. Talking about they'd been acquired by Disney, and a lot of Disney all over the place.
Yeah.
at this conference.
They're huge.
They are. Yeah. So he just gave kind of a boring keynote speech about how if you're making a game for little kids, you should put stuff in the game that little kids think is
awesome.
Cool.
Yeah.
That was literally like the thesis of this speech.
Well,
he answered questions, and it was interesting. You know,
and, like, you know, 2/3 of their staff is devoted to customer service.
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
5,000 to 7,000 emails per day.
Yeah.
From little kids. From CoolKid402.
Yeah.
Who says that he has a blue...
Greeble
named...
it wasn't
named Stinky. It wasn't Greeble. Greeble was the bullshit Bruce Sterling made up.
Yeah.
But that's tomorrow's keynote. See, we're jumping all over the place already.
Yeah.
I forget what the pets are called in Club Penguin.
Yeah, I don't know. There's some sort of puff.
And then he was talking about how when you email that kid back, you have to say, "Oh, Stinky sounds pretty cool. Tell him that my pink guy named Smelly says hi." Guy who made Club Penguin, terrible at ad-libbing names for pets.
Yeah.
Stinky and Smelly.
Yeah.
Then he changed it to Sparky once he realized that he was terrible at coming up with names. So then I went to a thing. Oh wait, yeah, well, no, you did that too. You did that. You were there at 11 next to me,
yeah,
waiting for the keynote to be over.
Yeah. Then I went to lunch back at the hotel.
Right.
Which was exciting. Not really.
Hot Stuff conveniently found us a hotel that was up a giant hill from the convention center.
Yeah.
Every time we went back there.
That was an unexpected geographical feature.
Then I saw Designing for Player Sociability, a guy, I don't remember who he worked for. I don't know, Multiverse. He worked for Multiverse.
Oh, well, and it was his name?
Bob Moore.
Okay.
Not a particularly confident speaker, so, and some of what he did was just show videos of him playing MMOs that I must, you know. One thing I learned is that apparently boring things are interesting to some people. He was basically talking about avatar-to-avatar communication and the limits of it and some of his ideas for what you could do to improve it. You know, and it was, you know, marginally interesting, not delivered with a lot of pizzazz, but basically entirely inappropriate to what we're doing, just kind of irrelevant unless we ever make a game where you're actually represented by an avatar and can see other people's avatars.
The one that I went to was comparing virtual property models, the business and legal perspective. Can you tell that I got to go to the fun talks and Jake had to go to the boring ones?
He picked his own schedule, gentlemen.
Yeah, well, I picked it based on what I thought you would go to and then picking something else. That one, it was kind of interesting. The guy was a lawyer. He was talking about like the sale of virtual property in games and stuff like that. It was mostly sort of either, you know, do you want to do subscriptions or do you want to do sort of transactions for money or whatever, for like items and land and whatever, which was, you know, again, not something that we would ever really want to do. And basically, you know, as long as you don't ever allow cashing out in a game, you're probably not going to be in trouble as a publisher or a developer. If the sort of systems where people can put money in and then, like I guess Linden Labs allows cashing out, where, you know, you buy Linden dollars with real money and then you can exchange Linden dollars for real cash later on if you want to, like, sort of buy back out. Which is, you know, that's an interesting model, but it leads to all kinds of weird legal issues for them.
Do you suppose if you made a little pet bee that ran around and you wanted that bee to be able to have sex with female bees, that you would equip your bee with a Lyndon B. Johnson?
Yeah.
I think you would.
Yeah.
That seems like the kind of thing that you would do. Ah, boy. Oh, wait. I'm not looking at anything on the computer. I'm looking at a piece of paper that's in my hand to figure out what's going on next. Not used to this. All right. So then I went and saw my new favorite dude, Stig Hedlund.
I think you just like the guy's name.
He has a cool name, Stig Hedlund. He's not even foreign.
Really?
Yeah, he's from California.
Oh, that's weird.
He looks like a Viking. And he just comes across as, like, the nicest guy in the world.
Huh.
He kind of ran the class like he was... He kind of ran the lecture like he was teaching a class. He asked people for examples of stuff and then just had something positive to say about everything that anyone said. Even if it was clear that was what was going on in his head was like, no, that doesn't make any sense.
Right.
Whatever. He did not have stickers. He did not have Gold Star stickers.
That's too bad.
Anyway, he taught us how to be sticky. The title of his talk was Sticky from the Start. He was basically talking about his experiences of designing the skill and character development systems from Diablo 2.
Which is cool.
Yeah, Diablo 2 is pretty awesome. He'd been brought in to Blizzard to, like, fix Diablo at some point in the middle of its development. The way that he described it, you know, sort of figure out like what was good about it and what wasn't good about it. He had a lot of interesting things to say about. He did a sort of a history of the RPG development thing, and there was a big decline before Diablo. There was role playing games, you know, from like sort of 90 to 95 when Diablo came out, were in about the same shape that I feel like adventure games kind of had been in for the past few years after that, where just nobody was really developing anything. Everything that came out for the last 5 years had just been sequels to things that came out in the early 80s when everybody was starting to do everything. Ultima, Might and Magic, you know, the wizardry games, late 70s, early 80s.
I feel like TSR put out those sort of dungeon crawly type games.
But they were
games.
Kind of in the last... I feel like that was in the latter half of the 80s.
Was it that early?
I think Pools of Radiance came out in 88 or 89.
Wow, I don't remember being that early.
I'm not positive. Maybe I'm wrong about that. But anyway, talking about Diablo and the idea of getting rid of a lot of these sort of tropes of tabletop role-playing games that had bled into computer role-playing games, like the fucking rolling dice to put your character together in the beginning, you know, which is hit a button to re-roll. So you just keep hitting a button until all of the numbers are maxed out, and that is very boring and dull, but you can't not do it. Actually, that isn't true. I never did it, but...
1988?
See, I know when stuff happened.
That's true.
It's weird. Every time my wife asks when a movie came out, I'll be like, I don't know, and then kind of guess, and then it'll turn out that I guessed exactly right. So that's just some strange. It's almost as though I know a lot about American pop culture.
Yeah, that's strange.
I can't figure it out, man. Anyway, he basically was talking about how, you know, the difference between the way that characters progress in Diablo 2 and the way that they progress in Diablo 1 was very sort of core to the way the game worked, you know, and it was, he was basically talking about building skill systems for games, skill trees, where I guess he sort of invented that structure that now basically every MMO uses to one extent or
another. It was funny that he said that the only reason that you couldn't respec in Diablo 2 was because they just didn't even think of it.
Yeah. When somebody asked, it seems like something that they would have added later if they really felt that way, but somebody was like, hey, why did you decide to make it so you couldn't unspend your skill points? And he was like, yeah, you know, I wish that I had thought of that, because, you know, I wouldn't do that if I was doing it again now. But, you know, but they took that into Hellgate London and they kept it. He seemed pretty sad about Hellgate London, and he didn't want to say anything bad about any of the people that worked on it. But I think everybody's sad about Hellgate London. It's a sad, sad story. Man, I read an interview with the guy where he was just being so upfront about what was going on, and it just made me kind of cringe. He was like, you know, just talking about how he and the other guy at the head of the company had like basically cashed out all their IRAs to pay their guy's last couple of paychecks.
Wow.
So that they could actually give them notice instead of just firing them all. Yeah, it was just kind of that really sucks that that was such a dismal failure. He talked about a lot of the mistakes that they made, and some of them I don't know if I believe that they were the real failures of Hellgate London, but anyway, that talk by Stiga. What's interesting is that I would say that that talk is what made me make a change that is currently in testing on dev that I should probably roll out tonight. But in fact, just reading about what the talk was about made me think of making that change. So I had sort of decided to do it and talk to Hot Stuff here about it before I even went into the thing. But yeah, what did you do Monday at 3 p.m.?
God, the worst talk of the weekend for me. Marketing versus production, which was, I guess in big game companies, there's like a lot of tension between the marketing department and the production department, and this talk was about that. I had no idea. It was terrible. There was no content to the talk. It was 20 minutes long and like an hour slot, and there were like nobody had any questions because there was nothing to ask about because it was just so dumb. That was just terrible. I don't even want to talk about it. So, but then we met up and went to a talk by Eric Zimmerman at 4:30. I don't know if I've met him before or I've seen him talk before. He had taught at MIT some, so I think I had either seen him around there or had gone to a talk by him or something.
Which one was he? I think I might have him. That was up with Jesse Schell.
Yeah, I think so. He was the one that spoke at this packed room, and it was very much a sort of a basic, like, here's how games work kind of talk. His talk was easy as fucking hard.
Was that the one where he did the massively multiplayer color matching game with the cards?
Okay. Yeah. He handed out at the beginning of the lecture an index card to every person in the audience, and they were different colors. And there were a set of rules about, like, you could trade cards with people near you or whatever, and you were trying to cluster colors so that you'd have the largest cluster of color. But it suffers from one major flaw in that by the game's design, you're supposed to go up to the front of the room if you form a group that's larger than the group that's already up there. Nobody wants to go to the front of the room.
Yeah, I mean, doing that virtually guarantees you're going to lose.
Yeah.
Right, so, yeah. What did he talk about? He talked about tic-tac-toe. I remember it being a pretty entertaining talk.
Yeah, no, it was definitely interesting, but it was not, there was not a lot of actual, like, useful information in there. It was sort of like, okay, if you've never thought about how games work before, here's a talk that talks about how games work.
Yeah.
And then we were like, okay, everybody in this room has already thought about this to some extent. You know,
maybe that isn't true, though. You know,
I mean,
maybe a lot of these talks... One thing that kind of bugged me about this conference is that there were sort of overwhelming numbers of people who all they did was either teach at one of the millions of sort of burgeoning game design degree programs at, you know, community colleges or fake University of acronym I made up just now. Like,
apologies. Of Advancing Technology.
Apologies if you went to someplace like DeVry or whatever, but, like, I just don't, you know, I feel like a game design degree from DeVry is identical to not having anything in terms of actually getting a job.
Maybe that would get your foot in the door for
as a tester for Midway,
yeah,
or something.
Yeah,
maybe.
Yeah. Because you're going to end up in the industry, I feel like.
Maybe that's true. I mean, maybe the game industry is big enough that, because I just don't think of you being able to, you know, it's like, I guess there are a lot of degree programs for, like, screenwriting and,
yeah,
you know,
well,
maybe
film
that,
school.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Yeah. In a way, though, I feel like to a large extent, setting up a game design program at your community college is kind of like having a how to be a professional baseball player degree program. You know, you're just sort of taking money from people by promising them something that you can't deliver, which is, you know, that's a crime. That's not an educational system.
So many jobs, or so many degree programs are like that, though. I mean, creative writing programs are like that in a lot of ways sometimes, you know, like, because, you know, you think, well, okay, this will let me, you know, write a novel or whatever, but, you know, you still have to get it published. It's just not that easy.
I guess that's true.
there's a lot of, like, I don't know. A lot of the liberal arts are kind of like that. I mean, you go in, if you're thinking about it as, like, I'm going to go here to learn stuff, and you don't really care, then it's fine. But if you're going there, like, yeah, I'm totally going to capitalize on this philosophy degree I got. Right. Open up my philosophy store.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're in trouble.
Isn't there actually a store called Philosophy? Like a clothes store for women?
There might be. There's Anthropology.
Maybe that's the one I'm thinking.
I think that's what I'm thinking.
You get an Anthropology degree to open one of those.
Yeah.
You could get a master's in Abercrombie and Fitch.
So then that night there was nothing specific.
We went to the Ginger Man, which is a cool bar if you're ever in Austin. 9th and Lavaca. There is a bar, 4th and Lavaca. 4th and Lavaca, there's a bar called the Ginger Man.
Yeah.
Tremendous tap selection. Big,
like 40 or 50 beers on tap.
Yeah. Big porch built right onto the sidewalk.
That was a common feature of Austin that I don't really understand. There were several restaurants or buildings that just built their sort of a patio. Like, not just, like, butting into the sidewalk, but covering the entire sidewalk where to get by them, you would have to walk out into the street.
There were always designated parking spaces on the street there. So you're theoretically not forcing people into traffic.
Yeah.
It seems very strange.
It was odd nonetheless.
The kind of thing that probably exists as a result of some grandfathered laws about zoning that did not have people's safety in mind the way that every other goddamn bit of legislation anywhere about anything is currently poisoned with.
Yes.
Safety's lame. Those regulations that make air travel safe. Fuck that.
You're just an angry man.
I know.
I think you hate flying, which is just doesn't help.
Flying. That flight sucked. The flight back here, we were on a little plane, like there were four seats across. I mean, I've been on smaller planes, but like, remember when we flew to Arkansas? Oh, haha.
No.
You didn't drove for
24 hours.
Yeah, you didn't live here when we flew to here. We were in a plane where it was like one seat and then an aisle and then two seats.
Yeah, I've been on those planes. Those are like prop planes too, I think.
No, we were not on a prop plane.
Oh, okay.
It was a jet, but it was just a little bitty jet. Yeah, this is fucking uncomfortable.
It was, we were pretty, there were a lot of, I'm not like super heavy people, but just like a lot of large people on that plane.
Like, yeah, a lot of guys that were taller than me, and it was deeply uncomfortable for me to be in that airplane thing.
Yeah.
Couldn't really stand up straight even in the center of the aisle.
So that was Monday.
Yeah, that's that. We went to the Ginger Man, we drank, we went back to the room and fell asleep.
Yeah.
And then got up and went back in the morning to see Hardcore Games for Casual Audiences by Jesse Schell.
Which was actually a really good talk.
It was, but I have it mixed up with the Eric Zimmerman one from
really?
Before, yeah. What did he talk about in that one? Look at your notes.
I took a lot of notes. He had like a couple of things, tips to like improve games. So he said, see it from their point of view, which, you know, that makes some sense.
NS-13 does suck.
Use the elemental tetrad, which is aesthetics, story, mechanics, and technology. He feels like a lot of games focus on a couple of those, but don't actually sort of pay attention to the whole thing. Myst, he said, was a good example of something that had good aesthetics, good story, good mechanics, which I kind of disagree with the mechanics thing.
Yeah.
And good technology. It used sort of the limits of things.
He was talking about how their plan at Cyan was to spend the last 6 months building an ending into Myst that was just
awesome.
Going to blow everybody away. It was going to be the most thrilling ending that any game had ever had. But then the boss was like, No, that is not what you're going to do. What you're going to do is you're going to spend the next 6 months making sure that this will run on
every
computer with a CD-ROM
drive. Every CD-ROM drive, every manufacturer, every make, model, and they did. And it was the number one selling PC game for 5 years, every month. Every month. I didn't know that. That was pretty amazing.
I had initially heard about Myst from my dad, which was weird.
Yeah, my mom told me about Myst.
Yeah.
She had read about it in some newspaper or magazine or something.
Yeah, my dad had read an article that was like, they were seeing a significant upturn in like, people getting therapy for being depressed when they finished it, because they were so into it for so long that when they finally finished it, it just left this void in their lives.
Like an hour and a half or something. It was not that long.
I finished it over a handful of 1 or 2 hour sessions. You know,
yeah.
That was I've told this story a million times, but Scully and I lived together very briefly,
right.
And we only had one copy of the disc at the time, so he would play it while I was at work, and I would play it while he was at work, and we'd have like 5 minutes in between when we could confer, and sort of. I'd play until I got stuck somewhere, and I'd tell him how I got there. He'd play until he got stuck somewhere, and he'd get past whatever.
I got stuck once in the game, and it was because I didn't know what pixel to click on to like find a key or something. Like there was something, just a very tiny detail of some room that I just didn't see, and I got very frustrated by that being there. That's the only thing I haven't looked up spoiler wise. But I didn't look. I mean, I didn't play it until 5-10 years after it came out.
Yeah.
So,
but I think the point that he was trying to make to some extent is that the sort of ubiquity of ability to run that was a major contributor to it being very successful.
Yeah,
it was
the fact that KOL runs in a web browser.
Yeah,
probably one of the reasons it was so popular.
It was a pain in the ass to play computer games back then. You know,
unless you're the top end machine.
Yeah, but even then, I mean, you know. Some games would come out that required extended memory, and some games would come out that required expanded memory, and so you, basically, in order to get games to run properly, for the most part, you always had to sort of rewrite AutoExecBAT and ConfigSys every time you wanted to play a different game, so you just end up with sections of them commented out and delineated as things that you
needed
to do
having to run
specific games. Yeah, maybe you had nicer computers than I did.
I don't know, that's just interesting, because I didn't play nearly as many computer games as you did either.
That could be. Yeah. But just, you know, fucking CD-ROM drivers. Back before Atapi, like, that was so much of what I had to do at my first job. And it was annoying as hell because there wasn't really an internet that you could typically get CD-ROM drivers off of. So we just had boxes and boxes of discs.
Just manufactured.
That came with every CD-ROM. You know, if somebody bought a new CD-ROM drive and wanted us to install it, we would make a copy of the disc, label it, and file it away in case anybody ever brought in a computer with one of those.
Wow.
So that we could get the goddamn CD-ROM drive to work so that we could reinstall Windows or whatever. And it's Windows 3.1. Which actually installed off of floppies. So.
Something else that Jesse Shelda said that was interesting was let them play their way. He was watching a woman, or he watches women play games all the time, and he was watching a woman play Bejeweled. And he's like, what mode do you play that game in? And she's like, infinite mode. He's like, isn't that the mode where it just never stops and you can't really die.
And there's no score.
She's like, yeah. And he's like, why do you play that? Like, that just didn't seem fun to him at all. And she sat and thought about it for a little while. And she's like, you know, it's like knitting. You know? He's like, well, when you knit something, you knit something to make something. She's like, no, you knit because, you know, the needles sort of, they make a nice sound when you're sort of knitting something together, and like the repetitive nature of the knitting and purling or whatever is very soothing, and it just sort of lets you sort of not think about anything for a while. It sort of takes your mind off stuff. It's very relaxing. And he's like, his mind exploded, and he was like, that is just a fundamentally different way of approaching a game than he had sort of ever even thought about. And so, you know, letting people sort of have their own sort of entirely different kinds of experiences with games and building in a bunch of different kinds of play styles seems like a really good idea. This is, you know, like, how do you make serious games for casual gamers and stuff like that.
Jesse Shell was the one who had worked on the interactive rides at Disney, right? Another one of those Disney things, like some Aladdin ride where you would get in it and you were actually piloting a flying carpet through some stuff. You know, he was talking about how important it is that, you know, they had to design all these games that people could just entirely figure out how to play in like 30 seconds.
Because the ride was only 5 minutes long, so any longer than that, you've just made them angry and whatever.
He talked about, and this is weird, I am really surprised that we didn't end up going to Disney Quest. when we were in Florida, because it seems like the kind of thing that I would have insisted on going to.
I know you've never heard of it before.
We drove past it a bunch of times.
No, didn't
we? Knew what it was, we just didn't do it.
Did we? I didn't.
I did. I don't know. Maybe I just was talking to my wife and not you. I get you too confused sometimes. Anyway, Disney Quest is like this arcade thing that they... Disney built like a... Basically like a GameWorks, right? Except with all their property, you know, rides and stuff. And he said that the reason that he thinks that it failed, it wasn't... He said, it's not that it's not making money.
Well, but their plan had been to put one in every city.
Yeah, their plan had been to build one everywhere, right? To for it to be like a nationwide chain of these things. And he said that, you know, when he was involved in the teams that were working on these things... Management's order was, you know, they said, well, do you want these things built for a lot of replayability and a lot of depth, or do you want them built for a really intense first-time experience? And management said, first-time experience all the way. That should be your entire focus. And it works for a theme park, but not really for an arcade, because you gotta get people coming back. You know, you gotta actually, you know, if it's a place that's focused on interactive entertainment, you really gotta kind of make it interesting to gamers. And
yeah, that was kind of interesting, because it's like making the stuff sort of interesting and fun wasn't the hard part, but making it have enough depth so that somebody who wanted to ride the same thing like 10 times could actually still enjoy it the 10th time. It's tricky.
So after that, there was the second day's keynote by Bruce Sterling. I hate myself for even saying this, but like, Bruce Sterling is to nerds what nerds are to normal people. I was really disappointed.
I don't know if that's the way he is normally. Like, but... I imagine he was probably asked to talk about computer entertainment 35 years in the future, right? Because, you know, it's been around for 35 years. What's it going to be? What's the next 35 years going to be like or whatever? And so what he chose to do was to pretend not to be Bruce Sterling, but instead... A graduate student of Bruce Sterling's, who's now 90 in the year 2043 or whatever, and who had time traveled back to give this talk to explain about what the game industry is like, or computer entertainment is like in the future. So, you know, ostensibly that could be kind of interesting, but it ended up being just sort of a musing on what like life will be like 35 years from now in regards to sort of technology and computing and that kind of thing, and didn't really talk about gaming per se.
It tried to be inspiring, like, you know, the basic premise is, you know what games are going to be like 35 years from now? Whatever you decide they're going to be.
Yeah. He talked about this very advanced game that he could play on his towel. Which we called Tetris. We probably had never heard of it because it was too advanced for us. But yeah. I was like, is that your point? Is the point that the games that we've been playing for 10 years will be playing 35 years from now? You know, because whatever.
So then after that, after the keynote, well, we went to lunch again. Probably went back to the hotel. Every single meal that we ate at the hotel.
Yeah. Mostly because of scheduling stuff. No, we had a dinner at High End Cactus.
Oh, right, yeah. I guess that's true.
And we, we were staying at the Omni in Austin, and there's sort of this nice feature of a couple of the floors there where I didn't really understand this when I booked the rooms. I basically just took one of the last two or three rooms in any of the hotels within like a five-block radius of the convention center. I guess they have club floors where every morning there's like a really sort of relatively serious breakfast outlay, and then in the evenings from 5 to 7 there's just a free happy hour kind of thing with snacks and free
booze.
Free booze.
Free, like, you know, like a little meat and cheese tray.
Sandwiches.
And like
shrimp cocktails.
The girl who's normally at the concierge desk there... Just serving everybody drinks.
Yeah. We saw last night there was a woman who was there on her own, and there were these two lawyers there, and we saw the sort of
primitive exchange, a mating dance.
Yeah.
They were, I think, the lawyers were there. They were in town, not as, they were there for some other purpose. They were from Houston, I feel like, this, and they had been back. The conference center, or the convention center, in addition to having the GDC going on, had like a thousand refugees from Houston staying there.
Yeah, there was a whole section of it that was just filled with cots. And a bunch of evacuation buses the first morning we got there. We were like, wow. So there were a ton of people. I mean, that was the other reason that there were no rooms available in Austin, because so many people had to
afford it and come to Austin and stayed in all the nice hotels.
And everybody had their dogs with them. It was just weird.
Because there were tons of dogs
in the hotel. Yeah.
Like, practically every time we got into the elevator for the first two or three days, there were dogs.
Yeah. Different sizes and shapes.
Spooky glass elevator, too.
Yeah, sort of open to the air. It's like, you know, like a 20-story tall hotel, and then on just one side, it's just this glass elevator that you can just sort of look down into the courtyard of the hotel.
It was a very strangely designed building. It's like a 20-story hotel next to a 20-story office building.
Both of which have, like, glass walls facing each other, and then there's, like, a roof over the
front desk and the restaurants and stuff, and the bar is downstairs. And then on the other side, there's, like, little convenience stores and like a Starbucks and stuff.
Right.
So very, very strange layout. So after that, I went to a panel. This was weird. It was. I thought it was going to be very similar to a panel I went to at PAX, which wasn't so much a panel. They were both just lectures. One of them was a guy that made that EETS, EETZ or EETS game, who had started working with Nexon, working on like a free-to-play, massively multiplayer, like, platform fighting game, I think, is basically what the thing he was working on. But he just had a lot of, like, you know, somebody said, what would you suggest as far as building a game, you know, just a game in your garage, and, you know, as far as accepting microtransaction payments, you know, how would you recommend doing that? And the guy was like, You basically can't. He was like, if you don't get any funding, I think it's basically impossible for you to create a free to play game that actually accepts money. And I just kind of wanted to yell.
This was at PAX. This was a talk at PAX. Okay.
And I was afraid that this talk was going to be the same, but this was from the publisher that was working with that guy, not that guy. And it was, you know, I don't know that I learned anything from it, but it was fairly reasonable. I mean, he talked about, you know, a lot of the things. He was like, you know, if you have a free-to-play game and you want people to give you money, don't have a bunch of content that's locked out from people who don't give you money. And that was something that I feel like, you know, our early intuition about that has served us very well.
Right.
You know, and I feel like we've been more careful than a lot of people would be, I think, to really, really not beat you over the head with, hey, we need people to voluntarily give us money so that
nobody,
we can eat.
Nobody ever, like, you know, I went to a bunch of these businessy type things. It was either subscriptions or microtransactions for gear in the game. The notion of just a donation thing was just foreign. Like, just nobody was.
We are basically microtransactions for gear.
I feel like that's what it has become, but that's not how it started. You know, it was self-sufficient just as donations.
Yeah, you didn't get Mr. A's for doing anything until a few months in.
And you know, Mr. Accessories, while nice, are not like the end all and be all. You know, since Mr. Store went in, I would say sure, there's some microtransaction type stuff, but we phrase it differently too. It's not set up like, here, buy this stuff.
Right. It's here's this, you know, here's a haiku katana, that'll be $10. Like,
yeah, it's like, you know, it's
I think that many people have argued, and really I cannot with a straight face say that they are wrong, that we might as well be saying, here's a Mr. Accessory, that'll be $10. But,
yeah,
you know. Yeah, that was the thing. The one thing that he said that I very fundamentally disagreed with was, he was like, you have to have two different currencies that don't mesh. You know, you have to have things that are only available for donation currency. And I just, you know, we would be nowhere if that was the case. if you couldn't basically donate to get meat by selling the thing in the player economy, then I feel like we would not have nearly the non-paying player base that we do, because they would feel like there was all this stuff blocked out.
They were locked
from
away.
Them, yeah, because they just could never get it, and we would not have nearly as many donations, because a lot of people donate just because they want a lot of meat. You know? Right. So it's, and he had also said, you know, don't hate your players who don't give you money. You know, don't think of them as a liability, because A, they provide content for the other players, and B, they can be monetized in other ways. And then he was talking about advertising,
yeah. Advertising was another sort of major sort of money source for a lot of other games.
Everybody who's interested in this kind of thing should go to Jonathan Blow's blog about Braid. And there's a section of a podcast of some people that, I don't know what they did on Braid, but he said they're in the credits, in case you don't recognize their names. But there is a pretty insightful rant about in-game advertising that I very much enjoyed listening to. It's about 10 minutes long. But yeah.
It's about advertising in general, too. I mean,
Yeah.
The notion that you're not, you know, they don't give away TV for free. They, you know, like, they're getting something when they advertise to you. So.
I was sad that we didn't end up getting to meet Jonathan Blow.
Yeah.
We looked him up to see what he looked like, and we saw a picture of him giving last year's keynote speech at the GDC, and he was wearing a fucking KOL shirt. And so, you know, it's like, yeah, I bet he would talk to us if we went up and, like, hi, this is who I am. God damn it.
Yeah. It's weird that we think he's so cool without ever having met him, just because we like the things he says and has written and stuff.
Yeah. So what did you see Tuesday at 1:30?
I went to Unlocking Flash to build the next great MMO, which was a largely technical discussion of, like, Flash's merits for building mostly three-dimensional MMO stuff. And so it wasn't as useful as I could have thought of. I think that we would enjoy finding some competent Flash programmer to do stuff for us in the future, and you know, I don't know. I was hoping that maybe I could find one there.
Yeah, but in fact, all we found was the same shit that we always find when we look. It was people bitching about being in the same boat that we're in.
Yeah, it's like impossible to find anybody who knows ActionScript 3 who isn't basically just learning it on the job. Which, you know, I don't know. Someday we'll figure it out.
The thing is, a community college Flash course is not going to put us anywhere near the level that we would need to be at in order for us to hire us.
One thing I did learn is that you do not build Flash games in Flash.
Right, you use Flex.
Yeah, Flex Builder.
Yeah.
Which I did not know. But I have not really spent any time looking into it myself, because I don't think I'd be.
I wonder if it wouldn't be wise for me to just try and learn Flex a little bit to see what we could,
what you could do next. Because if it's not that hard, you know, that would be kind of nice.
The next thing that I went to was actually a cool talk. I had seen this guy at PAX. At least I think I saw him at PAX. He says that I didn't, but totally did. Dave Grossman, who is the lead at Telltale Games, who does the Sam & Max episodic games and is working on the Strong Bad, this cool game for attractive people. He gave a talk entitled The Sandwich of the Month Club about his approaches to designing episodic content. And honestly, I felt like that, the sort of things that he was talking about were probably, just from a theoretical standpoint, probably the most appropriate talk to what we actually do.
Really?
Yeah, because he was just kind of talking about the pace of stuff. He did some stuff about, like, story arcs and the ways to develop compelling characters and stuff. And a lot of it was a little. Whereas KOL is a very, very text-heavy game, it is not a particularly literary game, you know?
In what sense?
So I guess a lot of the stuff that Scully does, a lot of the stuff that, you know, like the Crimbos definitely have, like, a strong narrative arc. And I guess that, you know, the game itself that has a tends to, it's very disjointed. I mean, I'm not a writer, you know, and so it's very disjointed. It's very much like the writing in a video game, you know, except that it's like funny instead of, you know, dodge the lightning bolts atop Thunder Peak Spire to reach the dark labyrinth of, you know, that, you know, it's kind of that sort of lofty,
right,
danger fantasy, like you know what I mean. But it's not, we don't really develop characters, you know, to speak of. We'll let the players do it themselves, because you know what, user created content. I heard that it's the future.
Well, I was gonna say it's full of copyright violations.
Copyright violations. Yeah.
We haven't gotten there yet.
Let's see. Yeah, that was a good talk. Dave Grossman's cool. Then I met Dave Grossman at the Wednesday night party that we will talk about. And like, I sat there and talked to him for 5 minutes, and all I did was just say bad things about his games. And I was like, man, I'm a real asshole.
That was funny.
Yeah. He was nice, though.
Everybody loves a critic. No, they don't. I went to a subscriptions versus free to play panel at 3 on Tuesday, and it was, I don't know, it was frustrating because it was very, you know, like the free to play is, you know, there's just a bunch of people monetizing like players by selling them, you know, spiky red hair or whatever. Like, it's not, you know, I don't feel like our stuff is really trying to like monetize our player base the same way that all these people are talking about monetizing. I heard monetize a lot.
Monetize. Yeah, there were a lot of people talking about monetizing a lot of things.
The subscriptions guy just kept sort of knocking the free to play, being like, you have no idea how much money you're making ever, kind of, and like you've got so many players and most of them don't donate. Don't ever pay anything and stuff like that. There's a tremendous number of free-to-play, like, hardcore MMOs out there that I didn't even know about. Yeah. A lot of them are, like, sort of Asian
yeah.
stuff.
A lot of, I feel like everybody thinks that the time is ripe to move their free-to-play MMO into a, you know, Western space, or move the concept of the free-to-play MMO into the Western market. And so I feel like there are dozens of games now, fairly high budget free to play MMOs, and that there are going to be hundreds within a couple of years.
Yeah, I feel like it's going to be a very crowded space. Like everybody's going to be taking everybody's market share.
Yeah,
you know, which is going to be weird because then nobody will succeed.
Yeah, I'm hoping that we can coast along on our World of Warcraft style behemoth powers for a while, because we've been developing content for so long.
That's true.
Right? That, I mean, the thing is, I feel like of the dozens of MMOs that are out there, we have 50 times the content of any of them. Our presentation is not... because they just don't launch with much.
That's true.
You know? They don't launch with much, and they don't... Even as slow as our pace of updates gets at times, it is still... You know, it's like a lightning relative to another
molasses.
Yeah, like lightning compared to molasses.
Yeah,
because it takes them so. You know, I remember talking to your friend in Denver who worked on Auto Assault, and I was like, yeah, you know, our rules have gotten so complicated, and the game has gotten so feature rich that it's like, if we want to add a new monster now, that's like an entire day of somebody's time just to put one monster together. And he was like, dude, nice. He was like, that you know, that is crazy fast compared to putting anything. And I would argue that a monster in World of Warcraft is not nearly as much content as a monster in KOL.
It's weird to compare, though, because of the whole, you know, having to render everything and 3D software and then translate that over and do animations on it and, like, you know, think about how it's going to look in the environment and, like, you know, there's so much more stuff going on there. And then, you know, it has, like, a bunch of sounds that it makes and game balance in terms of its, you know, hit points and damage that it does and stuff like that, whereas we have we have a little bit of that mass stuff, and then all of our time is spent writing it, as opposed to a little bit of drawing, and it's just done in comparison. I feel like ours is more interesting, sort of over the long haul.
Yeah, I mean. You know, I guess in general, like, you know, the content in World of Warcraft is like, you know, the interactions of NPC stuff, you know, and the sort of distribution of the content into these panoramic vistas, you know, that are cool looking and atmospheric and that kind of thing. But yeah, it's weird, you know. It's weird to think about. You know, like, World of Warcraft is a free-to-play game where you bought stuff. The other problem is any game with, like, real PvP,
mm-hmm.
where you're actually sharing a world with other people. I feel like so many of these games, the only thing that you can get from microtransactions is...
Cosmetic
stuff, or... I feel like in Asia, the big thing is, like, triple XP gain potions. And that's basically the way that they make their money, is by selling a day's worth of triple XP.
Huh.
Like, that is probably on the games that have that and a bunch of cosmetic stuff. I feel like it's probably... there's something, some game called Audition that the guy from Nexon, I believe it's Nexon that puts it out, seems that, because they're the MapleStory people. I feel like they mostly... He was also talking about, like, this is what you have to do if you want to sell prepaid game time cards at Target, you know, and like, honestly, I just don't see a future where you go to Target and there are hundreds of
there's hundreds of phone cards now,
but I don't think that there are hundreds of phone cards at Target.
There's like the kiosks that just have phone cards or whatever on them.
I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's possible. I think that there will not be hundreds, maybe, but you know, like 3 or 4 dozen. Different games.
Yeah, it's just seems like a weird thing to.
You go to Target and you buy. I mean, they have a whole section of DS games and PSP games. I mean, why is that fundamentally any different than buying a card, which you then take home and in your computer as your console?
Yeah,
you know,
sure. Where were we?
4:30 p.m. on Tuesday.
All right, so then there was a guy that worked on Wizard 101 and had messed with some other stuff before. Pirates of the Burning Sea he had done, and he was this was a very sort of technical, not particularly engrossing lecture until the very end, where it was a quest design and engineering in MMOs, and he was kind of talking about mission systems and the different ways that you can design mission systems to work on the back end in like a client server environment. And, you know, talking about the stuff that he did with Wizard 101 and stuff they did with Pirates of the Burning Sea. And then at the end, he finally started just saying, well, like, you know, why are we in a rut?
Why do we always kill 10 rats?
Yeah. And came up with a few ideas that I don't know that I really believe they were good, but I liked seeing that. The end of that lecture was kind of what I was hoping the entire conference was going to be like, which was people actually discussing their ideas about stuff, you know?
Yeah.
What did you do at 4:30?
I went to Economic Design and Management of Virtual Rural Worlds with a Large Shattered Population, which was a couple of the guys who designed EVE Online, Sam Lewis. And Sam Lewis actually was from... Where was he from? He did something else. But then Ejjolfur Gudmundsson, which is some Nordic...
Was he the big blonde dude in the kilt?
He was not in a kilt.
But was he the big blonde dude?
I don't know. He was big. I don't know. He was wearing
very tall, very broad, very blonde.
Yeah, but no kilt.
Okay, he was wearing a kilt the next day.
Okay, it's possible. Yeah, the guys that did EVE Online, a lot of them were kilty. It was kind of strange. They traveled in packs. They seemed to be very full of themselves in general. It was weird. It was like they felt like EVE was this big deal.
I mean, EVE is kind of a big deal, you know?
It's got 250,000 total players ever, basically.
Sure.
Okay.
They're all paying a subscription, though.
Yeah, sure.
And they are rabidly loyal.
That's true. They've got, like 30,000 concurrent users at the peak hours. And it's all the fact that it's all on one server, that's kind of cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. We saw some demo of some game at Gen Con that was a space fighting game where you'd... It was just... There's, like, this whole class of game, which I think is weird, which is you do some stuff, and then you're like, okay, I'm sending my fleet across the galaxy. It's going to take 20 hours for them to get there, and they're going to attack another fleet based on some sort of things that I do. And then you just do log off. You go do other stuff, and then you can have it email you when they arrive or whatever. And we were watching some of the space battles. I was like, that is the most boring space combat I have ever seen. It was like a bunch of ships stationary, sort of facing each other, shooting each other with lasers. Nothing obviously happening.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I think the battles go on for hours because they want people to be able to sort of have time to respond and stuff. It's like, what? You know, I can see the idea of somebody being busy and they want to have, you know, they want to do something for a little bit and then sort of set it in motion or whatever. And I think EVE Online has that same kind of thing where, you know, you're skilling up when you're not, when you're offline or whatever. But in practice, that just seems weird. But yeah, so it was kind of a frustrating talk, the economic design one, because the first like 45 minutes was just basic economic theory that, you know, if you didn't know the economic theory, then it was way too fast and not detailed enough. If you did know it, it was just retarded because you already knew it. You know, like, there was no point in them having gone over the sort of monetary theory that they did or whatever. And then they finally started, at the end, they started talking about sort of the actual management of a large-scale economy and stuff, and the impact and the sort of the pressure points that they have as designers to sort of keep the economy doing what they want. They referenced an interesting paper about Ultima Online's economy. When Ultima Online was first designed, they had designed it as a closed loop where players, like, stuff would enter the world based on stuff leaving the world.
Right, like kobolds wouldn't drop iron swords if there was too much iron in the player economy already.
Right. And what they just did not anticipate was that players like to hoard stuff. They like to keep stuff. They don't sell it. They don't sell it to vendors or whatever. They just like to hoard it. Especially if they have a lot of storage space, they'll just fill it. And so eventually, after just like a very short time, like monsters were just not dropping anything, and you couldn't buy anything from any vendor because everything, like all of the sort of the set amount of stuff that was supposed to be in the world was just like stored up in player inventories. And so like they tried to continue to to keep it a closed system, and so they just like they would inject some more like stuff into it, sort of increase the overall size of it, and then it would all just sort of get stuck in those player inventory systems. And it was just kind of fascinating that like you just don't expect people to do things like that, because that's not at all the way people are in real life. You know, you don't hoard things indefinitely. You know, you're
right.
But
we want money so that we can buy things.
Yeah, and you know, you keep stuff around, but it just doesn't have nearly the impact. But there's just something about the when there's just no burden to keeping in, you know, an arbitrary amount of stuff, people do it. I mean, we clearly see that. You know, people in KOL have just ridiculously large inventories.
Yeah.
But luckily, we never even considered having a closed economy. So yeah, so eventually they had to do the sort of sources and sinks, which I think is a much more rational way to run a game.
You know, I think I've read that paper, actually.
It's possible.
Now that you mention it. I remember reading an academic paper about the economy.
It had a bunch of typos in it.
It's weird. Diagrams.
There were some diagrams.
Yeah. The last thing I remember seeing about Ultima Online was some instructions on how to make something in your house that looked a lot like a piano by just dropping a bunch of objects on top of each other.
Weird.
Because everything just kind of stacked on top of everything else, so people would make a lot of sculptures.
Yeah, that was, I mean, that people would, there was like some guy who had like 10,000 shirts in his house, just because he could, and because it looked kind of neat. It's like, wow.
Do you suppose that he had 10,000 sharks?
I don't think so.
Do you suppose that the group of people from CCP had a large shark population in addition to their large shard population?
I don't know. The way that they described the economy in EVE Online was very kind of tedious and not interesting to me. Like,
yeah.
A bunch of decentralized markets, a bunch of like resource, like a lot of the game seems to revolve around like these different resources that players have to go out and then like acquire, like mining asteroids and stuff, and I'm like, and there are like hundreds of these resources. It's just weird. So I guess something that was interesting was the 50. So there's like a central zone in Eve. It's like a sort of a, I guess the Empire zone or whatever. It's sort of protected space.
Yeah, 0.0 space or whatever.
50% of players never leave protected space. Hmm. So like, they assumed that a lot of like that people would sort of enjoy the sort of build your own society, protect yourself, sort of live your own ways out in space, and almost nobody does. Almost everybody clusters in protected space, which is interesting. You know, it's very much not the
shit
Firefly.
Totally forgot
thing
to do the Talk Like a Pirate Day thing.
Oh,
god damn it! I'll just do it after I'm done.
I assume that you were doing that at the hotel.
No, I forgot about it.
Oh, okay.
I mean, it wasn't ready. I was waiting for.
Is rollover?
Yeah, rollover just ended.
It's not. I mean, it's not gonna be a big deal if you add it.
It's gonna piss some people off if they've played all their turns. Maybe I'll take a music break and do what of it I can.
Okay.
At least get the stuff dropping as a placeholder, and yeah. So let's do that. Sorry, kids. I'm gonna. Oops. I'm gonna play 3 Breeders songs. Should I have this ready? Wait, that's only like 7 minutes of music. I'll do one more.
song. Thank you.
hey, yeah. I like doing things plenty far ahead of time.
Yeah, I was gonna say, with so much advance notice, you could stream.
Yeah. Sorry, kids who are logged on now. Yeah, but you'll need to log out and log back in to get the holiday to properly trigger. And I'm hoping that everything is working okay. There is a new item that is not yet implemented, but will be within a half hour or so after I get off the radio, I'm assuming.
Unless he forgets again, which is totally possible.
I won't forget again.
Yeah.
Hey, look, Amplitude logged off and then logged on, and people aren't going to know if it worked. I need to put an announcement on the main page that saying that it is Talk Like a Pirate Day, the way that I do the...
Oh, on the main page.
Yeah, I do all the other holiday announcements.
That's what you're saying.
You want to talk about something, actually, while I do that?
Sure. I forget where we were in our whole progression. Did we finish? We finished Tuesday?
So talk about the party Tuesday.
Yeah,
night.
God. So Tuesday, after the talks, at 7 p.m. at a place called Maggie May's on Sixth Street, in Austin, there was like a GDC official networking party. So we went there. They had free drinks, which is always good. And we were sort of sitting around, and basically everybody was talking in the little groups of people that they came with. Like, it was, nobody was really sort of branching out and talking to other people. And we ended up spending most of the night just sort of trying to find people that we recognized that we could try to talk to, and just, like, had zero success. It was sort of a spectacular social failure on everybody's part, because I don't feel like anybody really got any solid networking done there. There was a band that was playing. They only did covers of songs that were also on Rock Band or Guitar Hero, which was pretty funny. But they were okay. But yeah, it was strange, because it's like, game developers are, you might expect that they're not necessarily the most socially apt people. And so you get a big group of those, 90% of whom are male, together in sort of a place with some loud music and some free booze, and it just didn't really go anywhere as sort of a socializing event, which is kind of frustrating. So we ended up drinking for a long time, and then heading back to the hotel and drinking some more, and then we fell asleep, and actually decided to sleep through the first session and the keynote on Wednesday, because
the keynote was just some audio thing.
Yeah, it was next generation audio was the keynote, and the first session was kind of, didn't sound like it was going to be any any good either. We'd kind of gotten a little disheartened by the sort of feeling of none of this applying to us, and us being ostracized outside the industry and stuff like that. I guess that was the most frustrating thing, was just the Tuesday gathering was like just this weird sort of reiteration or whatever that we are not part of the industry. We're not people that are going to go schmooze, and we're not going to market ourselves or whatever. We kind of like to meet people and have interesting discussions, but that's just really not the right venue for it.
I feel like it could have been.
Maybe.
Later on, things definitely picked up on Wednesday. So
yeah, that's true.
We slept late. Maybe that was it. Maybe we just didn't enjoy Monday and Tuesday because we hadn't had enough sleep.
That's possible.
Yeah.
That is possible.
Maybe we were only industry outsiders because everybody in the industry had been sleeping more than we had.
That's possible.
So at 1:30, when my day started, I went to the only roundtable discussion that I had gone to the entire time, and it was exactly what I was hoping GDC would be. It was the title of it was Taking the Grind Out of the MMO Grind, and it was just basically a bunch of people who, there was lead designer for EverQuest 2, Damian Schubert was there again.
Designer for EQ1 too.
He had worked on EQ1. He was not the lead.
Okay.
There were some other EverQuest guys there. There was
EVE people.
There was a live team manager for Ultima Online. There were a lot of the EVE people. There was
a guy that worked on Tibia, which is another MMO that has been around for 10 or 11 years.
Yeah. German-based.
Yeah. And we ended up talking to those guys for a long time later, but we'll get to that. And basically, it was just a lot of people who think about, you know, building MMOs and putting quests in them, talking about how things work and, you know, the ways in which different means of giving content to people compare, and you know, what can we do to make things more interesting for people, and it was neat. There was not, you know, it was not like nothing earth shattering happened, right? Nothing.
Nobody's mind exploded.
Man, nothing blew my mind completely. But it was cool to be in a room with those people talking about that kind of stuff. I didn't ever say anything because I felt like there were a few points where I could have jumped in and said some stuff, but I didn't because I got there too late, so I didn't actually have a chair at the table. I was just sitting back against one of the walls. There was a block designer for Magic the Gathering there too,
huh,
which was pretty interesting.
That's cool.
You know, talking about how they have the you know, they kind of design like an MMO because buying cards is sort of like leveling up.
I guess.
But it kind of is. I mean, in terms of, and so is, you know, the way that you stop the power creep is by having the tournaments just be cards from this year, you know.
Right.
So everybody suddenly gets a chance to be at the top of the heap again. Like giving somebody an opportunity to do something totally new that they suddenly have a fresh start chance to excel at.
They also have to buy a bunch of new cards.
But yeah. You know, they still have their lands.
Great.
Yeah.
I don't know.
And you know, probably to get a competitive set of cards for any block, this is probably only $300 or $400 a year, which is less than an MMO subscription.
Depends. I mean, if you want to build a deck with four rares, that could be.
It depends.
$50 right there. You know,
if you buy them on eBay, or if you just buy a couple boxes of boosters every time one comes out.
Yeah, but you're not going to even get one of each of the rares if you do that.
Yes, you are.
Yeah, whatever. I went to a talk by a guy who makes a game called Sherwood Dungeon, which some of you might have played. It's been around for about 7 years. And it's interesting. It's a Shockwave-based game. It was developed entirely by him and his wife. Like he's outsourced a little bit of content here and there in terms of like art assets or whatever. But he was just a one guy shop. He had sort of worked in the industry as a designer in console games, PS2 in particular, I think. And he'd been involved in the beta, I think 8.5 Shockwave, and decided that he could finally sort of make something on his own. And so he made this really sort of very, very casual, extremely casual 3D free-to-play MMO called Sherwood Dungeon, and it's sort of took off. His revenue stream came from advertising. He had a banner ad underneath the thing, underneath his little window or whatever, and he's had a lot of success just with that. There's some technical discussion of like Shockwave and its sort of capabilities and stuff like that, and the reason that he chose it, or whatever. But then there's just a lot of discussion of his experience as a extremely independent game designer, which mirrored, you know, KOLs in a lot of ways, and it was really interesting to hear his choices and in sort of that journey or whatever, and just sort of hear about his experiences and stuff like that. It's kind of neat to see the different ways that people go about sort of designing stuff when it's just them and when they're just sort of basing stuff off of things that they like and things that they've seen and what they would like a game to be. Jick had played the game really early on, and I was like, "Have you ever played this?" He's like, "Yeah, it was totally broken. You know, you couldn't do any damage to anybody. I think, you know, the damage wasn't broken or working or whatever." And I was like, yeah, he was describing that when he first put the game out there, you could swing a sword, but it wouldn't actually hurt anybody. And he just hadn't put that in yet. Like, he developed it a lot of, in very much a similar way to KOL, where he just put something out there to begin with, and then that wasn't even close to a finished game, and people started playing it right away. And then they were sort of around while he was updating it and sort of actually turning it into a game. But when when he finally decided to actually make weapons do damage, there was this actually sort of a large uproar in the community. They were like, "What isn't this a game about pretend fighting and like just playing around and stuff like that? Now you actually hurt people." It was interesting because he'd managed to get some like really just sort of, I think, like heart style social casual players that enjoyed sort of mock fighting in this online world. And they were really upset when all of a sudden they were hurting each other when they swung swords and stuff. And it was just cool. And, like, I guess next week he's going to be introducing mounts and pets. And so he was doing a demo. He's doing a demo where he, like, mounted up on this horse and was riding around. And he was doing it on a live server. And the people were just like, looking. Like, all the other people who were in the game were just sort of turned around and were like, what the hell? Because, of course, they've never, like, their client has been updated to sort of have the ability to see that, but they've never seen anybody riding a horse around or whatever, so they were like, what the hell is going on? Which I thought was kind of funny.
That's cool.
Yeah. No, I thought that was kind of neat. But
then, strangely enough, he and his wife were sitting in the two seats behind us on the flight back to Phoenix. They had a connecting flight going back to Canada, where they live.
Yeah. They were just super nice. Like, the two of them, like, he was extremely well-spoken and just a very, very nice guy. Like, I wouldn't mind sort of keeping in touch with him sort of as time goes on, just to sort of...
That reminds me. I need to get his email address from you so that I can send him that link. I found the site that I was talking about, so I can...
Yeah, I think his... Not that our game design philosophies necessarily mesh a lot, but there's stuff that he's doing that's really interesting, and that I think there are things that we have done that he could probably sort of learn some lessons from. So it'd be kind of nice to have a dialogue with him. So Wednesday then, after having a bunch of talks that just weren't applicable or interesting or whatever, started to sort of shape up for us. I went from that to a sort of another sort of business legal talk, which was with another lawyer, about copyright issues in video games and virtual worlds, which was actually kind of interesting. Of all the sort of like business talks, that was sort of my favorite. Because he talked just a lot about what the issues are for us in terms of being careful of copyright and stuff like that. He was the one that said, wherever there's, as opposed to player-created content is the future, player-created content is full of copyright infringement. So, there's actually a lot of interesting stuff there. Like, if
that's only because Playboy has copyrighted the cock and balls.
Yeah.
Actually, that's entirely... I don't know. There were cocks and balls in Playboy.
That's true. It's all girls. All the time.
Playgirl.
No, I don't know. I've never...
Yeah, whatever.
...purchased one. Just for the articles, anyway. I like the idea of not going to jail for violating copyright. So that was a good talk to go to.
Come on. Where's your sense of adventure?
Yeah. What did you do at 3 p.m. on Wednesday?
I forgot to update the mall table.
Okay. That's what you did at 3 p.m.?
I say update the mall table because that's what people started calling it, but that's not even right. It's just pushing some files out. 3 p.m. on Wednesday, I went to Everything I Need to Know About Virtual Worlds I Learned at Theme Parks by Patricia Pizer, who... She had worked at Infocom.
Really?
Yeah.
That's
20 years ago, she worked as a tester at Infocom.
Weird.
It was kind of interesting.
So she's like a Boston person.
And she, it was kind of interesting.
Wasn't it mostly just talking about
How awesome Disneyland is, and it wasn't really about... She didn't do much to tie it back into game design, but it was... it's largely about attention to detail and really, like, sort of crafting an experience and making sure that you can look around and know where you are.
You know what I like, actually, is in World of Warcraft, when you throw something away, you never actually see somebody come and take the trash out of the thing and, like, goes underground. That's my favorite part.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
I like how in EverQuest 2, there's only one place you can drink, and you can only get in there via special invitation if you're, like, a VIP.
Yeah. Or in Ultima Online, where you can always see the castle off in the distance as sort of, like, this, like, beacon.
Right, right.
Yeah. Yeah. So nice.
But anyway, it wasn't a bad talk. It was... She had told some interesting stories about, like, the kind of progression of whimsy in architecture and the public space. And it
what does that mean?
Just like, I mean, that's not really the way that she described it, but it was like, you know, talking about this kind of period of time where a lot of people started building castles because they were cool looking.
Okay.
You know? And
I have yet to see a lot of people building castles.
Well, a lot of the castles in England and in Europe are not castles that are from the time of castles. They're castles that a wealthy person would decide that they wanted to build a castle to live in instead of a nice house.
Huh.
Like, and then she talked about this thing. It was basically like prior to 1900, there was something in France where a group of people would pay to get on this fake boat inside a building. And the boat had underneath it a bunch of air bladders that would inflate and deflate to rock the boat back and forth as this massive scroll went past you on the wall, making a kind of fake immersive experience of like sailing from France to Turkey. Right, just with all the scenery on the wall, and you know, just that was like this really weird thing at the time. It was like this kind of weird immersive ride thing, you know, 110 years ago.
I mean, that sounds very similar to what a water ride at Disneyland would be today.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Huh.
It was, you know, it was just kind of neat to, but yeah, I mean, she spent a lot.
So that's why what cave paintings are all about? That they actually just had flooded caves and they'd like get on some sort of piece of driftwood.
There wasn't actually any water involved in this thing.
Oh, it was just air bladders.
It stood still. The air bladders would just rocket around, and the scenery scrolled by, and then you would ride back because you know they had to reset it for the next people, so they figured they might as well charge you for that experience too.
That's funny.
Yeah. You know, she said a lot of stuff that I can understand the game design lessons inherent in it, I think, but she didn't make them particularly explicit.
Huh.
You know, she was like, here's pictures of all the different trash cans in Disneyland.
Right.
And it's like, okay. But but her point was the trash cans in your haunted forest should look different than the trash cans on Gumdrop Mountain.
Right.
So that your haunted forest is a real place and Gumdrop Mountain is a real place, you know, like just the whole you should be able to look around and tell where you are, which is something that I feel like World of Warcraft does spectacularly well.
Yeah, that's true.
You know, the fact that the sky is a different color
in
every zone, yeah, you know, that's neat.
Yeah, I definitely agree. That's something that I feel like it's like little touches like that make things like Lord of the Rings Online, you know, I guess it's trickier, a little bit trickier for them, because they're actually trying to be true to a world that has, in theory, been sort of mapped out, but I had no idea where I was. Like, I knew it was in the Shire, but it was like every freaking hill was the same as every other hill, and it was kind of boring. I guess that was also because I was delivering mail as part of the quests.
And pies,
yeah.
Now my cat is helping me do the radio show. Let's see. That was you through the. Oh, so the talk that I went to, and this was a fantastic note to leave the convention on. My last talk was a guy doing a seminar called "What Your Mother and Your 10-Year-Old Can Teach You About MMOs," and it was basically a talk about how casual gamers feel about MMOs and describing all of the different models of sort of casual games that fit some aspect of the MMORPG, right? Like his slides were like casual massively, and then talking about like how different casual games make the players aware of each other and how they actually see each other. Okay, next one is casual multiplayer.
Man, like what?
And this is to what extent the features of these various casual games are actually multiplayer. And then went on. And the most exciting thing about the talk was at the end, he went through three or four games as examples, and the last one that he pulled out was Kingdom of Loathing. And I was all high. And he was all high.
That's funny.
Yeah. And I went and talked to him afterwards. They're working on something that's basically like a 3D world where you run around as avatars, but then can play mini games with other players in the space. I'm glad that I'm glad that the cat is biting holes in the rubber plant. That makes a lot of sense now. That
rubber plant, but I...
And the rubber plant came from. Don't bite holes in the plant.
And then at...
I talked to the cat as though she speaks English.
At 4:30 on Wednesday, I went to ARGS, which is basically a talk about alternate reality games by the guy, Alan Lee, who was involved in some of the more well-known alternate reality sort of things. He did the thing for the AI movie that came out. I don't know if people remember that. There was like a whole hundreds of fake websites and stuff like that that sort of led people onto that. It was interesting to hear how the sort of the genesis of that, like Steven Spielberg came to them and he's like, I want, when people go to AI, I want them to feel like they already know that world. That basically seeing the movie is in some ways a sequel to something that they've already seen, something that they've already experienced. And so that was what they were trying to achieve. And I'm like, I feel like it, in my mind, it wasn't particularly successful in that regard, because whatever. But to me, that kind of explained a little bit of like how the movie opens, because it doesn't give you a lot of context. And I feel like Spielberg wanted people to have had that context externally to the movie before they even went there.
Did you like AI?
I liked the beginning, and then I kind of hated the part after he left the family. I felt like it was just kind of dumb. I don't know. There were lots of parts of it that I just felt like were uninteresting to me. And the ending was kind of dumb.
Yeah, the whole... It just went on for a half an hour after it ended.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah. The aliens and stuff. The other things that he did the he worked on I Love Bees, which was the Halo 2 thing, which was way more complicated than I had realized. It involved calling thousands of payphones throughout the world and playing segments of a radio show that they had recorded. He did Kathy's book, which I don't know if you've heard of that.
Kathy Geiswhite?
No. This is a diary, basically. You can go to like a Barnes & Noble and buy this thing that looks like a diary. And it's like Kathy's book or Kathy's diary or whatever. And it says, if found, call this number. And there's like a phone number underneath it. And then as you read it, it's basically written like a diary of a teenage girl. And she's like, yeah, I broke up with my boyfriend today. And you're like, you turn the page and like this like ripped photo falls out of the book, and you can like take that photo and you can like paste it back together. And on the back, it's got like, his name and his phone number on there. You can call that phone number and it's his answering machine. And then if you keep reading the book, you can figure out what his password is, and you can go and you can listen to all his messages on his answering machine if you wanted to. And the whole book is kind of like this, it's an immersive book that is like tied into the real world in just a ton of different ways. There's a bunch of stuff that's sort of hidden in there that if you find out what it's talking about, you can like call a phone number, or you can go to a website or something like that, or like just a bunch of neat things, which sounded like kind of cool. And I don't think it was a promotion for anything. Almost all the other alternate reality stuff has been like marketing for something. But that was just sort of a thing that they came out with. They came out with also a thing called EDOC Laundry, which EDOC is code backwards, and it's basically a bunch of clothing that has puzzles embedded on the clothing. And there are things like, you know, you have to, like a shirt that you have to fold a particular way, and then you can see a message, or shirts that have like stuff sewn into them with strange thread or whatever. Stuff that you have to get hot before something shows up.
I thought you were going to say stuff that you had to get high before you understood it.
That very well may be one of the puzzles. And then he did something for the Nine Inch Nails, the most recent album they had that came out. It was really kind of interesting. It was a very, very convoluted thing that culminated in this kind of awesome thing. They basically, 50 of the sort of most diehard fans that had been sort of partaking in this sort of like alternate reality thing, they got sort of like pulled out of a concert. I forget how it happened. They got pulled out of something. They got put on a bus and like driven through the desert. They got blindfolded, driven through the desert, taken to this like abandoned warehouse in the middle of the night, and then they got there, and then Trent Reznor gave them like a private concert. They got about five songs in, and then one of the walls of the warehouse blows up, and a SWAT team comes in and starts shooting at them. And they have like they've put some plants into like they had like five of the people who were on the bus and blindfolded and went the whole thing were stuntmen, and they like the SWAT team grabbed them, like smashed them into the ground, and like blood splashed everywhere, and the people just like everybody just like ran back for the bus. They got on the bus and they like took them home.
Wow.
Yeah, and they each one of the people that was on that bus has a cell phone, like a special edition, like very limited edition, very special cell phone. That no one has ever called, but it is important. So they're going to do some sort of sequel to that whole thing.
Huh.
Yeah. No, I mean, like, the stories from these alternate reality things are just awesome. Like, the stuff that they do, that they think of and do is just really, really cool. It's just such a small number of people that actually get to live it.
Yeah. It's like I feel like in some ways it's like the mystery hunt runaround, right? Like,
yeah,
they're so great, but hardly anybody gets to do it.
Yeah.
And that's always very dissatisfying to you.
Yeah. Well, to me in particular, but yeah. So like, I mean, and they're, you know, mystery hunt is they try to be pretty good about it. I think they, you know, people who want to do the runaround, they'll sort of do it with them or do sort of a sort of version of it. With people who didn't get a chance to get there or whatever. But
and then John Popper asks why they want to give you the runaround.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I would enjoy very much making, not necessarily alternate reality games, but games that are sort of embedded in the real world a little bit more fully.
It reminded me of this thing that I saw a long time ago. Roy made fun of me for doing this. It was basically a thing that you would sign up for on a website where it, over the course of like a week or two after you signed up for it, you were getting these emails back and forth between this guy and this girl, and it was just sort of like their relationship ending.
Huh.
And I thought it was really interesting, just as kind of a, you know, as kind of a sort of experimental work of art. Roy just called me out. Gay.
Yeah. Have you seen the movie The Game?
Yeah.
That's a cool thing.
Yeah, that was a really good movie.
I feel like that would be a cool thing to be able to do. So that was the end of the official talks. And then Wednesday night there was another sort of official party. This one was at a place called Mohawk.
It was a really, really cool bar.
It's a neat venue, yeah.
It's very, very dingy, very grimy, very run down, very sort of Tatooine looking. But it was it had a sort of a decent sized downstairs main indoor bar, and then several tiered patios with stairways going between them, which is always, I always really like that. One of the most exciting things about my yard is the sort of crazy layout of the yard and things on multiple levels with
you would have really liked my treehouse when I was a kid.
I bet I would have,
because it was multiple tiered layers, yeah, with staircases and ladders and ropes and stuff.
Things that are laid out like that really excite me.
Your house is kind of laid out like that.
I know. I fucking love this house because it's all just crazy.
It's like some insane person folded the blueprints and they made it anyway.
like Sarah Winchester got a hold of the.
She the one that built that house with just hundreds of additions. Like,
yeah,
because
some fortune teller told her that
if she ever stopped
adding on to her house, that she would die, or that it would anger the spirit of her husband or something.
Yeah.
So she just kept having crazy.
That's the one that has that door that just drops off from like the third floor. Like,
yeah,
it's just like a sheer drop off.
Stairways just running up to the ceiling and not going anywhere. Yeah,
that's cool.
I was really fascinated by that story. When I was very, very young, I got a book from the library. Oh man, I didn't tell you about the nerdy ass thing that I found. All right, so when we were going through a bunch of boxes of photographs of my grandma's, and I found this thing that she had clipped out of the newspaper when I was like in first or second grade, and it was "What school rule bothers you the most?" And they asked all these kids, and I was one of the kids, and the rule that bothered me the most, all right, this was what my thing said. I don't like the rule that says we're only allowed to go to the library one day a week. The reason that I don't like this rule is because I like going to the library. And all of the other kids were like, I hate that there are rules
that we can't fight. I hate that we only get three recesses instead of four or whatever, you know? And mine was just like, you can't go to the library anymore.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I know. It's
where are those kids now?
Well,
fighting.
Probably. Yeah, they, you know, they probably
going to
are.
Recess.
That's right. Well, right now it's Thursday, so they can't afford to drink more than one night a week. But tomorrow
they hate that rule.
Tomorrow, yeah, they do hate that rule. And the reason that they hate that rule is because they like being able to afford to get drunk.
Yeah.
Although I don't understand. Okay, the thing is, the beer that they drink is very cheap, right? Because, you know, a bottle of Bud Light back home is probably only $2. But since it's goddamn Bud Light, you have to buy 40 of them to get drunk.
Yeah.
Anyway, we were at that bar. And I saw the guy who worked on Tibia from the taking the grind out of the grind round table, and I was like, all right, we're gonna go talk to that dude. I'm gonna network. I'm gonna make this happen. And we went and talked to him, and the other guy that was with him also worked on it. Hadn't been in the panel, or at least didn't talk, so I didn't know who he was. But ended up just having a really good conversation with them for like 2 hours about our games. And that was... Tibia is interesting. It's basically like Ultima Online. Game with no level cap. Basically unrestricted PvP. Where if somebody kills you, you lose 10% of your character progress.
Yeah, in every dimension. That was something. And all your items or something, like everything you're carrying.
Yeah.
So it's hugely punitive.
Yeah.
But it sounds like...
But it seems to form a rabid community.
Yeah. No. It's kind of... The idea sounded kind of cool.
It's 11 years old, and it is still... It's subscription-based, and it is still sustaining a company of, like, 27 or 28 employees.
Yeah. It sounds like they're porting the whole thing to cell phones or something.
They have, I believe.
Wow.
It was very interesting the way that... And I feel like... What I know of German culture, German people tend to run their lives the way that I run my company, right? I remember the teacher that I had for 1 year, it was just a guy from Germany. He was like, you know, we think it's very strange that all Americans are just so comfortable buying everything on credit. You know, he was like, in Germany, if you want a car, you wait until you have enough money to buy a car, and then you buy a car, right? And he was talking about, the guys from Tibia were talking about how, you know, there were like four college students that put the game together initially, and that they're still heading up the company, and they have never gotten any outside funding. You know, they've always been very conservative, sort of the way that we are. You know, where I've never gotten a loan for anything for the business. Right? I don't hire somebody unless I'm confident that there is, you know, still enough money for us to operate for a good long time, even if there's a significant decline in the amount of money coming in. You know, it just... The whole, like, American style of relying on constant growth in order to be profitable is just... It just makes my stomach hurt, you know?
Yeah.
Not because I think that it's unethical, but because I think it's fucking scary. You know? Because... I don't know. It is just so important to me to not ever have to have a real job again that I'm going to do everything that I can to ensure that, you know? And
yeah.
Turns out that's probably good for the company's longevity as well as my own. So then we met some of our World of Warcraft cronies, and I had the presence of mind to go back to the hotel room after 10 beers. Hot Stuff stayed out another 3 or 4 hours after that.
Yeah, that was a bad decision.
Yeah. I was good and drunk, and I was good and hungover for most of today.
Because we had taken pretty liberal advantage of our final... happy hour at the hotel. And then we went to Mohawk and had a bunch of free
beer. Yeah, it was open bar. That was the nicest thing about that is at the first place, the first night, there was a tab open for the people who were there, but you could only get domestic beer. This other place, everything was on the tab. Every drink was... So, you know, I was able to actually have some whiskey and then drank a lot of Sierra Nevada, and it was like... They knew how to take care of them at the Mohawk party.
And then we went to Lovejoy's and drank yet more beer.
Shot some pool.
Yeah. And then I went to Aaron's house. I'm sorry, Aaron, but your house is terrible. but it was interesting.
Well, so it turns out that our GDC wrap-up
Lasted 2 hours.
Lasted the entire duration of the show. And
we did not answer any questions, I am sorry.
Not. That's all right. I'm going to see if Fusi Bong is ready to go over. I'm assuming that he is. I'm assuming also that I know how to write the word ready.
It's exciting, though. This time next week, Con will be getting underway.
Yeah, that's true.
So
I wonder when Scully's flights come in.
I'm not sure.
A nightmare gets here day after tomorrow, and we start building shit. Notably, a trebuchet. Yeah.
I don't think we're gonna use it at Con, though.
Yeah, that'd be awesome if we could get it finished by then, though. And although we don't have, we take it to the Tempe Center for the Arts and just launch rocks through the windows.
That would be kind of awesome. Actually.
It would be. Yeah. All right, well, we're gonna leave you with one last Breeder song, and then place you in the capable hands of Fusilaban, who will undoubtedly play some video game music or some shit. And I'll talk to you Monday.
Have a good weekend, everybody.